three, four.
My very special guest today on the telephone is John Lankford, who is with the band The Mekons, and he's also been with a bunch of other bands and musical projects. He's also a painter. He now lives in Chicago, but started out making music in Leeds, England, in the mid-70s with The Mekons, who also worked closely with Gang of Four at that time. And amazingly enough, The Mekons will be coming to our little city, Santa Cruz, on September 29th, 2016, at the Crepe Place. And John Lankford, I'd like to warmly welcome you. Hey there.
Hey, how you doing? Good afternoon.
Hey, really good.
Sorry, I'm a bit late. I got confused, but that's nothing new.
Yeah, confusion arises sometimes in us human beings. It happens. And I'm excited that you'll be in Santa Cruz. Where are you now on your tour?
We haven't started the tour yet. I'm in Chicago preparing somewhat for the tour. We're meeting the rest of the Mekons up in Canada in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, fantastic. Hey, I'd love to hear a bit about the early days. And a lot's happened since then that I want to hear about, too. But in 1977, 78, 79, there was a tremendous upheaval and excitement with new music that eventually got labeled as punk rock. And your band, The Mekons, who I think you originally played drums for at that time, you guys would play with Gang of Four at shows and borrow their equipment. I was just looking at a 1979 New Music Express that I have with Gang of Four on the cover, and they talk a lot about the Mekons and playing Mekons covers at their shows. What was the excitement at that time? What do you remember being most wonderful about starting off playing music at that time in England?
Well, I think, you know, to be honest, it was a bit of a reaction against what had happened in the rest of the 70s. When I was a little kid, there was glam rock with stuff like Slade and T-Rex and David Bowie, which I found really exciting. But by about 1974, that was all considered to be very uncool. And there was this kind of weird 60s hangover progressive rock music going on. I would go to concerts and it would be just a load of guys with really long hair and beards smoking pot and playing free jazz kind of explorations. And it was a really strange time that there wasn't much going on at all. So, you know, when I was actually 15, 16, which would have been the time I would have been, should have been really excited about music, you know, but we had moved to the States and, you know, was doing stuff over there. You couldn't, it was just a kind of twilight of cool. I'd go and see bands like Yes or Genesis and just didn't, you know, wasn't working for me. There was something wrong with it. And I saw a band called Dr. Feelgood on a regional TV show and was really shocked at this band playing like really tight, hard R&B music, really loud, and they all had short hair. And they definitely looked like they didn't smoke pot. It was, you know, definitely definitely a different energy coming out of the TV set. And I was quite fascinated by them, but I didn't know where they played. They played mostly in London, I guess. And by the time I moved up to Leeds, the first people I met the first day when I got there were the two guys who were going to become the singers in the Mekons. And we started talking about music, and they mentioned Dr. Feelgood as well. And they said, our friend Andy, which is Andy Gill, he's forming a band. They're going to be a cross between Dr. Feelgood and the Velvet Underground. I thought, that sounds really good, except I don't know who the Velvet Underground are, so I better go and find out. But I was, you know, I had a drum kit, and I was straight out of school, high school, and away from home for the first time. And, yeah, it was a really exciting time when the Sex Pistols and the Clash came to play in Leeds. We, you know, it was all over by then. We just threw away our paintbrushes and on fans. Yeah, the Gang of Four had a rehearsal room, and they would let us use their gear when they went for a drink. And the whole idea of the Mekons was just to be the Gang of Four's opening band. We had no ambitions beyond that, and certainly no ambitions towards having a 38-year career or whatever.
The song "Never Been in a Riot," I just played a little bit of that, and it's featured on this album from 78-79 called Mutant Pop from Fast Products. That song, would you say something about that? By that time, The Clash had come out with their song White Riot, and I think that your song Never Been in a Riot was somewhat of an answer to that, or another point of view.
Well, I know what The Clash were trying to do with the song White Riot. But it was the way, that song was used. Politically, it was quite extreme up in Leeds at that time, and it was a long way from London, and there was a very, very dark, kind of long-standing core of racism, and racist street politics. Kids who identified themselves as Nazis, and very anti-Asian youth and anti-West Indian youth. And The Clash with that song was trying to, they were pledging solidarity with West Indian youth around a specific historical event, which was the riots of the Notting Hill Carnival, where the police clearly attacked and intimidated West Indian youth. And I think The Clash actually witnessed that. And then they wrote this song, White Riot, about, how white youth should be doing the same thing. But by the time it got up to Leeds, it was became like an anthem for extreme right wing kids. And they even had, as punk came up, these right wing kids even had bands. And there was a kind of idea that punk, because there's like people like Sid Vicious and Susie from the Banshees wearing swastikas in London to shock, up in the north of England, that became more of a call to action for some elements, and we were pink old lefties, and we got very much on the sharp end of that. So we hated White Riot as a song, and we wrote Never Been in a Riot because it was a kind of description of what it was like to be a middle class white kid, But having said that, by the time we'd written the song and recorded and started doing some gigs, we ended up in loads of riots because our gigs became flashpoints for, political violence. So,
yeah, interesting. There's a lot that has come out of punk rock over these years. It's pretty amazing. And one part of it that is fascinating to me, because I was really attracted to punk rock as a teenager, and then also quite repelled by it at the same time, seeing kids with swastikas. To me, it seemed like punk was about freedom and political radicalism. And it's interesting how quickly freedom movements get grabbed by fascists or authoritarian-minded folks, and they use the same styles or music for their own purposes. It's kind of interesting. What can you say about the politicalness of punk? I know that you you generally describe yourself as a socialist, I think, and I noticed that you've been working on some political activities in Illinois, where you've lived for quite a while, working against the death penalty. I'm curious, how important do you think it is that punk rock is political? Do you think it started out as a political thing?
Yeah, I think it was, definitely. If you look at British punk rock and you see where it started, it was under an allegedly socialist government at the time. The government of James Callaghan was the prime minister, and there was, garbage piling up in the streets, and he was fighting the unions when he was meant to be. He was basically funded by the unions, and they had this thing called the Winter of Discontent that was going on. This came after, two miners' strikes earlier in the 70s, the three-day week with Ted Heath's conservative government, shut down You know, there were power cuts. It was a pretty crazy period. And I got up to Leeds right at the tail end of that in 76. And and then you had this looming specter on the horizon of Thatcher. She was coming. We knew that the whole time, that she was probably going to be the next prime minister. And it was pretty terrifying. Yeah, there was racism. There was a massive, industrial confrontations. It was a very troubled time. And I think punk, unlike the music that came before it, which I kind of despised, punk actually addressed it. It was political in nature, that we were rebelling in a sort of against the generation that had come before us. You had people like, I love David Bowie, but you had him flirting with fascism and, doing his little Hitler salutes. And that was like, even though he's a major influence on punk rock, I thought that was just so facile and stupid. And then someone like Eric Clapton saying, let's keep Britain for white people, at a concert when he was drunk. It was a strange time, so punk, I think, for us, it was implicitly political when we started doing it. A lot of our songs, early on were quite kind of chest-beating. We had a song called Fight the Cuts and Reclaim the Night and all these sort of left-wing slogans. We were very interested in, employment issues, feminism, anti-racist causes, stuff like that, supporting trade unions, supporting firemen. We were out on strike when the band first started, so we did a benefit for firemen and, went on to the coal mining issues and stuff like that. But, there was no real way for us. I'm not sure it was like that for everyone. It was just sort of fun and drugs and rock and roll for a lot of people, probably. But for the Mekons and the Gang of Four, definitely. I mean, the Gang of Four definitely would set about trying to create pop rock songs that are really exciting, that embrace really serious sort of Marxist criticism of culture and society. So it was a heavy time, ambitious, but we didn't really, we didn't even have to talk about it. That was just the nature of where we were as art students up in Leeds at that time, and the climate, political climate in the country. It was inevitably, it was a rebellious thing to be a punk rocker, and it was inevitably going to take on the form it did for us.
Do you have some take, would you say, on how successful punk has been in terms of being revolutionary, presenting political ideas, presenting a different way of creating music? Maybe, the stereotype or caricature of punk, which is actually real, I think, you can tell me, is that you didn't really have to know how to play your instruments, and certainly you didn't need a lot of in-between people, managers and everything. You didn't necessarily need a record label. You could create your own tours, record your own music, all of that. How successful do you think punk has been in inspiring young people to be politically aware and to be creative in the ways that they enjoy?
I don't know how successful. I mean, it's a moment. It was a moment in time where everything seemed possible, and it passed very briefly, and we crashed head on into the mechanics of the music business, of what was acceptable and what was possible. I totally believed in the idea that you didn't have to be able to play that well to make something exciting. We were artists, we were art students. At the same time, there was a lot of heavy metal bands speeding up their music and getting their trousers taken in and just playing, speeded up heavy metal. And that's punk rock. And the music industry, while at first completely confused by it, got the lid on again pretty tight quite quickly. But the thing was moving. It was evolving. What the music industry wanted is to identify something and then be able to sell it. And what people, particularly in the provinces of England outside of London, were doing was making stuff that was not really that commercial, highly experimental, very political, and stuff that was really hard to commodify and make have a broad appeal. And I thought we were part of that, but you know, we got sucked up in the major label thing. We thought we could change the beast from the inside. We were quite, you know, naive and optimistic at the same time, and you know, we fell foul of that. But I don't know. I still, for me, you know, in terms of what punk rock isn't like, a postcard of a kid with a Mohican standing in front with a leather jacket standing in front of the Houses of Parliament. You know, it's it was a moment in time where he said, oh, everything must be questioned, anything is possible, and you can basically, you don't have to follow the rules. You can have a band, and it could be people that can't play, and you can do whatever you want, and it's valid, you know.
Today, I'm really pleased to be speaking with John Lenkford, who is with the band The Mekons, who have had a tremendous longevity since the mid-70s, playing, recording, and evolving personally and musically quite a bit. At some point, you all started becoming quite interested in American traditional music and hung out with some really great musicians in the Midwest of the United States and started incorporating that into your music. Tell me, how did that come about? And actually, you know, I would love to hear too, you just touched on the idea that you had with the Mekons of, okay, we'll go inside of the major record labels and work with them and try and make things more egalitarian from the inside. Can you describe some of how that went? I've read that you guys got fired by one of the record companies eventually, but tell me a little about that experiment, doing that.
We were crushed by capitalism. It's simple as that. The band really didn't really survive the first encounter with the major labels. We didn't understand what we were doing. We basically said we wanted control, we wanted this, we wanted that, we wanted this, you know. So we gave them, as my friend Kevin said so eloquently in the Mekons documentary, we gave them absolutely no reason whatsoever to promote us or support us in any way. You know, we... And they didn't, you know, once the accountants got involved and saw what was going on, it was over, you know. So we were one album, gone, you know, and it was devastating for us as people. It was like this real total failure, and I think it took a while for us to recover from that, but for some reason we did. Not quite sure what the motivation was to keep going. Now, but I think it was, you know, what's kept the band going all across all the years has been a kind of camaraderie and sort of social grouping as much as anything else.
The film Revenge of the Mekons is wonderful, and I watched it recently. I would highly recommend that. And I understand there's a new album that is also a book and part of a video project that's coming out soon called Mekons Existentialism.
Existentialism just came out today, I think. September, is it September the 1st today?
It is.
Yesterday. It is. Then it just came out.
It's, at least in the promo material, it's described as a hymn for post-factual democracy.
Who wrote that rubbish? Yeah. No, that's entirely accurate. I don't know. I think it's trying, you know, you can try and link it in with the current election campaign, but, you know, there's a sort of osmosis that goes on when we're writing songs that what's going on immediately around us always ends up in the songs, and that's what we always thought was, you know, the importance of what we were doing through the years, you know, it was... We were actually trying to describe and reflect the world that we, you know, lived in. So, yeah, we do live in a post-factual democracy, and here's some songs.
I recently realized that a song of the Mekons is used in a car ad. It's for Acura, and it's the song is what was it?
It's called "Where Were You."
Yes, and it's interesting, and I'd love to hear how that came about and how you feel about it. It's even interesting, you know, the ad is kind of a 30-year celebration of the brand Acura, and there's video of flashy cars and kind of 21st century factory workers assembling cars, and the narrator is saying, when you're young, you do crazy things, you do wild things, and he even says, when you're young, you ignore hierarchy and empower anarchy. And underneath that is your great song, "Where Were You," with the snare drum building up and then exploding. It's interesting too, you know, I talked with Andy Gill from Gang of Four recently, and he's made a few original songs for Deutsche Bank and for Ford, and "I Love a Man in a Uniform" almost was sold to the United States military in an ironic twist. It did not happen, but they were beginning to try and work that out. Tell me about the use of these songs, and how did that go for you, having "Where Were You" used in the Acura video?
Well, it was presented to us by an advertising company that they wanted to use the song, and then they sent us a clip, and they said it was going to be just a online thing for internal kind of promotion or something. It was all very vague, and we said, "Oh well, we'll have to." It's the original band, so I said, "I'll have to get in touch with everyone and ask everyone that." So that was a bit of a pain, and I expected everyone to say, "No, stop that. We don't want that." And that's not the way it turned out. Everybody was kind of like, "Well, what's the point? You know, if they've done it, we don't really care. It's 38 years old, so maybe we'll just use it, and maybe we'll just go with it." And then it came back that they wanted to use it as a major commercial once the company had presented it to Acura, and then it was going to be on during the Olympics and the NBA finals. So I got back in touch with everyone and said, "What about that?" And then I think with the Mekons, basically, no one's made any money out of the whole thing for all those years. So we thought we might as well have the money, and we could use it to support, you know, struggling artists.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
It does make sense.
I can honestly say there wasn't a lot of hand-wringing or upset about it, you know, because we were all middle-aged people who drive cars, you know. So, I mean, I didn't really feel like, you know, we will not have our music used in such a terrible thing, you know. It's I don't know, it just seemed rather silly, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting, of course, you know, there's different parts to the whole thing. You're a band and you want to keep making music and supporting other artists, and that requires some resources like money. And then, you know, another perspective on punk and it being very independent and some of it being even anti-capitalism, it seems like it would conflict with
selling things, so it's, you know.
Say that again?
So it was heavily anti-capitalist, but we were always dependent upon selling things, you know, and it's part of the entertainment industry. I think quite early on we realized that we were actually describing our position within the capitalist structure rather than saying we were setting up an alternative to it, which is naive and stupid, you know.
What do you think about the potential of having a different sort of structure outside of capitalism? It's too, that sounds impossible.
I think it'd be great. But, you know, I got two kids and the mortgage to pay, and I really haven't got time to set up a system outside of capitalism right at this moment. I'm open to ideas. We try to find ways of subverting our, what's the word? Our dependency on an obviously corrupt and imperfect system, and we try to find ways to get around it. But essentially, you know, we're in the entertainment business as much as anything. You know, it's corrupt as hell and tough to navigate. So,
yeah, I think so. It's rather complicated to try and do something creative and independent in such a tight structure. I'm speaking with John Langford, who is longtime musician with the Mekons. He's also formed a bunch of other bands, including the Three Johns, the Waco Brothers. He's also a artist and painter, and the Mekons are performing at the Crepe Place in Santa Cruz on September 29th, coming up later this month. Just today, the Mekons have released Mekons Existentialism. It's an album, a book, and a video. Hey, would you say something about the other musicians that are touring with you? I think that Steve Golding is playing drums and Lou Edmonds is in the band. And these folks have played with some of my favorite bands, including the Mekons, Gang of Four, The Cure, Poi Dog Pondering, The Damned, Shriekback, Public Image Limited, Billy Bragg. Are those guys touring with you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's Steve and Lou joined the band, I think, in the very end of 1984. And they've been in it pretty much on and off all the time. We've been doing things since then. And it's Sally Timms, who's been performing live with us from around the same time, but was in the band a little earlier. Susie Honeyman was a violin player, joined in 1983. There's Dave Trumfio, who's been working with us from the 90s on. He's a Chicago musician, but he lives in L.A. now. And then we have Rico Bell, who also lives in L.A., but he's from Yorkshire. And, you know, we joined the Mekons about 85 as well, I think. So,
John, one of my favorite concert movies is Erg, A Music War. And I went with my friends, and yeah, we saw it over and over. Gang of Four, The Dead Kennedys, Au Pairs, Steel Pulse. I just looking around at stuff about the Mekons, I came across a poster that was advertising the concert at the Rainbow Theater. That was the filming of that, you know, a few bands for the film Erg. It said Steel Pulse, Gang of Four, Au Pairs, and the Mekons. The Mekons didn't appear in the film. What's the story there?
A publishing company decided they didn't want to give the film producers a deal on the publishing, so we weren't included in the film. Everybody else decided this was going to be a great thing, and they should cut a deal and give a reduced rate on the publishing. We just signed a publishing deal. We were signed to Virgin. Virgin Records had just fired us at the time. But their publishing still held our publishing. And I don't know if it was an act of spite or stupidity, but they decided that they weren't going to do a deal with the producers of Erga Music War, so we weren't to be in it. Which is, you know, pretty stupid, really.
Yeah, it's a shame. You guys would have fit in there absolutely perfectly. Obviously.
Well, there is, and we couldn't even find it. We tried, when the directors were making the documentary, we tried to get hold of the footage of the band from that night at the Rainbow, and I think it was like September or October 1980. I remember it being a really good show, and we had I've got photographs. We just come back from a 3-week European tour, and we went straight to the Rainbow in Finsbury Park and had a pretty good night, you know, and thought it was all fantastic. And yeah, but there you go. One of the small disasters of dealing with the major labels.
Yeah, I'm sorry that happened. I love that film, and it would have been sweet to have the Mekons in there as well, of course. We were talking about political qualities of music and punk rock earlier a little, and I just want to hear a bit more from you about that. I came across a song that you all did in 1989 called Empire of the Senseless, and it's a pretty clearly stated criticism of some government activities, surveillance, national security stuff. How important is it to you that musicians or artists are commenting on things that are going on now? And there's plenty going on. The United States is constantly at war. There's drone warfare, prisoners being held at Guantanamo without trial for 20 years. How important is it to you that musicians or artists are political these days?
Well, it's all we have, really. So I think it's really important. You know, I can only speak personally. I'm sure some people are quite happy, you know, making music and not doing that, and don't feel it a role for musicians. I feel, you know, the kind of lineage that we link ourselves to is probably that of a folk tradition, and that music is kind of like it goes way back before the contemporary media, and it's a way of telling stories and telling and addressing things that are happening in the real world that affect people's lives. So, yeah, we're kind of programmed to do that now, really. I think it'd be very hard for us to think about making an album that didn't address what's going on. We don't necessarily address it directly. Sometimes it's fairly oblique, but, you know.
Yeah. Hey, I just want to ask you one more question, and I look forward to seeing you in Santa Cruz on the 29th. Punk rock is sort of famous also for kind of self-imposing at times this idea that, hey, if you actually get good at your instruments, or if you actually sell millions of albums like a band like Green Day, that you're not punk rock anymore. And I'm curious to hear from you about that. The Mekons, I mean, obviously you have gotten better over the years because you're playing a lot, and you've continued playing and producing albums and touring. What do you think of this notion that if you get too good or too popular, it's not punk rock anymore?
Well, I can't really comment on the popular thing. That's never been an issue for us, but I don't know. It depends how you play your instrument and to what end you play your instrument. The band, the Mekons, has always been kind of about exploring, you know, the limits and the possibilities of what a band can do. And quite early on, we realized that, you know, just basing it on amateurish bashing around, you know, while that was great in the one particular moment, wasn't anything that was sustainable or anything we would be interested in. So when we had the chance to play with Steve, who was one of my favorite drummers, who was never, as far as I can tell, never a bad musician. Yeah, it was just, yeah, we play with him. But he's, you know, someone who doesn't just use his skills to elicit, you know, sort of praise and show off. Someone uses his skills in the purpose of telling the story of the song and, you know, being part of the group, you know, being I like a lot of records with really good musicians on it. So, and I like a lot of records that are really popular. So, I don't know. Those are both those things, I think, you know, kind of whether you can play well, you know, good, or whether you make money, you know, good, is they're kind of, they're not of any interest to me as questions, really. Sorry.
No, I appreciate that. And I appreciate the Mekons, and I'm grateful that you're still around and still making music, and I'm delighted you're coming to Santa Cruz on September 29th to the Crepe place.
When we're being paid that night only in crepes, so and that is our attempt to set up an alternative to capitalism.
It's
we're gonna get 2,000 crepes and eat them all on the spot.
Crepeism.
Yeah. It's all a load of crepe.
I like it. I'm gonna come in there and try and be one of the first to join in the new crepeism.
Yeah, please do.
Hey, I'm really delighted we had time together, and I wish you well and the band, and I hope Mekon's Existentialism sells well. And thank you
I tell you what, Mekon's Existentialism was in profit before we even finished writing the songs. It's a fantastic, it's amazing what you can do when you don't spend any money.
Fantastic.
It is a new business model, though it does exist within what I would say is forms of consumer capitalism. But it's an interesting business model for a band to be able to be not losing money before they even started. And that was our goal with this one. So
fantastic. I'm glad that it happened that way.
It's our special secret.
Well, maybe I can get in on the secret while we're eating crepes.
Yeah, I'll let you know how to do it.
Thank you. Hey, John, thank you very, very much.
Lovely to talk to you. Hello to everyone in Santa Cruz, and we'll see you soon.
Great, thank you. All right, enjoy the day today.
Okay, bye. Okay,
bye now. John Langford from the Mekons. And the Mekons are playing in Santa Cruz. I can hardly believe it. They started off in 1977 in Leeds, England, with Gang of Four. Gang of Four would have shows, and during the breaks, these guys would get on stage and play the Gang of Four's instruments. Here they are 40 years later, still playing. Here's a little Gang of Four. Here's a little Mekons. The Mekons have a ton of albums, trust me. And they're quite different from each other. There's some that is really noisy punk rock, some that sounds kind of country western. Let's check this out. And thanks to John Langford for phoning in.
Of a man.